Party. I think we are just starting exactly on time. So it's my pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, Elaine Van Mel, and I think she's familiar to most people in the room, but let me just tell you a little bit about Dr. Van Mel. She is an education scientist. Her PhD is in education, real expertise in change and innovation. She's also just arrived back from the Canadian Conference on Medical Education, where I was saying to her, this is a bit unfortunate, the timing of this presentation, because she just did 8 presentations in the past few days. 2 workshops, 1 oral presentation, and 5 presentations to different administrative bodies, really to disseminate her work, that she chaired the CAME working group, which authored a paper, a position paper, which will be to the benefit of all of us in health sciences education, on scholarship in health sciences education. So she was as busy as you could imagine anyone would be at a conference, and came back with 1 day respite, but probably not respite, because she was preparing this presentation. So it's my absolute pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this. And you're going to speak about a very important topic about the hidden curriculum, and with particular relevance to our own clinical clerkship here at Queen's.
Thank you, Leslie. It's nice to see so many familiar faces and to be back and with the group. And I wasn't even thinking about all the stuff we've done over the past few days, but I have to say that of all the things, this has actually been one, I think, of the more intriguing and interesting projects. And I did actually a kind of a Reader's Digest version or a 10-minute presentation at CCME on some of our findings, but it's really nice to have an opportunity to elaborate because, you know, it's so hard to put this all into 10 minutes, and so it's nice to be able to talk a little bit more fully about it. Now, I must confess that I left my notes at home, and so I'm going to gladly wing it, and, you know, my husband always tells me that I actually do much better without my notes, so we're going to find out. So this study started about a year and a half or so ago, and Libby was instrumental in working on the project with me, and then there's a whole group here at Queen's as well. Well, thank you. There's a whole group here at Queen's as well who were quite instrumental in getting the project underway and looking at the theoretical framework and telling us whether or not this was the approach to use. And so we really wanted to look at the relationship between the hidden curriculum and patient-centered care. And this whole project really started from the Associated Medical Services Hidden Curriculum Summit. That was in March 2011 on the hidden curriculum. And this was 2 days that a number of us went away just to talk about the hidden curriculum in medical education, people from across Ontario. And 2 things in particular really struck me that came out of that summit. One is that Charlotte Reese presented her study of 690 students looking at the hidden curriculum and specifically producing dilemmas for students. And so she characterized it as when students really feel pressured to go against their idealized notions of what care really is all about. And it really showed that this can cause quite moral distress for students. And out of that kind of keynote presentation, I really started thinking, but is the hidden curriculum only always negative? Is it only always dilemmas? Or are there other ranges of experiences we should be looking at as well? And then the second key message that kind of came out of that conference is Bill Schreg, when he presented, said it's really important that as we look at the hidden curriculum, we explicitly tie it into patient-centered care. So it's not enough to say, well, we think the hidden curriculum impacts on students and how they think about patient-centered care. We really need to tie the two in. And so coming back to Queen's, we said, well, let's see if we can actually put a study together that addresses those two issues. And so this study in particular explores the range of experiences that students have when it comes to the hidden curriculum. And it also tries to tie those experiences directly into their ability to practice patient-centered care. And so we set it up this way, went back to the literature and said, well, what exactly is the hidden curriculum and how can we put a framework together to actually address all of those pieces? And so we went back to Hafferty's work, who I'm sure is probably well known to most of you. He's kind of the guru in the hidden curriculum in medical education. And he very clearly distinguishes the hidden curriculum from informal learning experiences. So So he says the hidden curriculum is that set of influences that happens in the system that are really hard to kind of put your fingers on. But how we can see it is how it impacts on students and their informal learning experiences. So those two are separate. One influences the other. And then we continued in the framework to say, well, are those experiences then positive and negative? And how do they impact on patient-centered care? And so that's the framework that we put together based on how these work. And so I just have to back up for a minute before I talk about the method and then the results, and to say that we very deliberately used this term patient-centered care. And so the AMS Hidden Curriculum Summit actually turned into the Phoenix Project, a call for caring, a much larger project. And in their project, they actually deliberately moved from the term patient-centered care to person-focused care. And so I went back to the literature and saw that Starfield, in fact, distinguishes patient-centered care as being that time specifically around a disease event, whereas person-centered care is looking more at the person in their holistic environment. And to be honest with you, everything that we used was person-centered care, not patient-centered care. Even though they call it a patient-centered care tool, it actually gets the elements of person-centered care. And then we also went back to the environment of Queens, to the hospital, to see, well, what kind of terminology are they using? And it's really patient-centered care, not person-centered care. So we decided to stick with that term. The other term that we deliberately used in our study was this term enact. So at the very end of the diagram, it's about how students enact patient-centered care. And enactment is what you take away and then take into another role. And so we deliberately were looking at students and their learning experiences, but how would they then enact what they were learning as they got into their own role as a physician? And so, you know, it's interesting because actually all of these, this is a total aside, but all of these images come up when you Google patient-centered care. I love to do that when you're doing a talk and then you kind of Google the term and see, well, what kind of concepts come up. And what really struck me, I don't know if you see it in here, but it's how even though it's patient-centered care, in each of the diagrams, the provider is kind of standing over the patient, and the patient is kind of, you know, it's just an interesting statement. Anyway, total aside. Maybe there's an incorrect word. So, our method. We used a mixed method, sequential exploratory design. I know there's like long terminology, but the whole point of that is if you're going to get positive and negative experiences, somehow you need to design a study where you're going to maximize your ability to actually get those experiences. And so we started out by using, with Queen's Medical students at the end of their third year clerkship. And we did it at the end of third year clerkship because we wanted to make sure that they had enough experience within the clinical environment to actually be able to give us some good feedback or good data on what their experiences are like in relation to hidden curriculum. And so we used a questionnaire that gets at the extent to which students experience patient-centered care deliberately, because we thought if we use that, then we can actually classify students into their different levels of experience, high, medium, and low, in relation to patient-centered care. And then deliberately select students to interview so we can see about this range of experiences. And so that, in fact, ended up to be a good strategy. So this C3 questionnaire gets at students' experiences in relation to role modeling, in relation to how patients are actually treated, whether they're treated as objects within the clinical environment. And it gets at the support for their own patient-centered approach to care. So to what extent is that really supported in the clinical environment when they're a student? And so we use those three indicators as a way of grouping students into these high, medium, and low experiences. And I don't have enough time to go into the whole thing, but I'll just show you an example of how that turned out. So this, for example, is students' experiences of role modeling that is captured in relation to how their role models communicate concern, encourage participation, take patients' concerns seriously, develop good rapport, and to what extent they actually explore the emotional aspects of illness. And so this is how students responded on a scale of never to always. This is a compilation of these different questions that they responded to. I think there are five in all. And so we then took a look at, we divided the class into thirds and said, well, one third is in this low range, one third is in the medium, and one third is in the high. And then we could use those results to actually identify students in the low, medium, and high who would then go on to interview. And so it turned out that there were 25 students out of the 75 who filled out the questionnaire who agreed to a follow-up interview. And we then chose three who described high experience with patient-centered care, three with medium, and three with low. So that was the quantitative portion. And there's a lot of more information that actually came out of those questionnaires, but I really want to focus in on what the interviews told us, because that really helps us to see the framework much better. But I do want to say that when you look at then the high, medium, and low, and we simply counted kind of the number of positive and number of negative experiences, it did in fact work out that using that strategy gave us a nice range. Now I have to say that we're now going to move into the qualitative part, and I'm always a little bit uncomfortable putting numbers into a qualitative study. But this is really simply just to show you that we were able to get the range of experiences we were looking for. But I wouldn't draw any conclusions that there were 20 positive and 15 negative comments. It's just really about the range. It was a small study, and so we have to really replicate it on a much larger scale to get a sense of whether these numbers have any particular meaning. All right, so I'm going to show you the results now, and I'm just going to take us back to the framework and start with the hidden curriculum, move into the informal learning experiences, and then talk about how does that impact on students' ability to enact patient-centered care. So in terms of the hidden curriculum, here are the examples that came up in this study. So the hidden curriculum, again, is that set of influences that talk about how the system is shaped. And so the experiences that students talked about were too many patients, too little time, facing the limits of medical expertise, and so when you have a patient in front of you and there's really nothing more you can do, dealing with difficult patients, and I put difficult kind of in quotations because it's really all relative, you know, in terms of who thinks a patient is difficult, but that's how they were described. And then finally, kind of finding a work-life balance. And these were this was the context within which students then experienced their informal learning experiences. And so within this context now, so this slide shows you the kinds of informal learning experiences that students actually had. And so primarily it was about students in clerkship observing either residents or preceptors. There was also a few examples of deliberate role modeling, and I'm going to talk in a minute about how I made the distinction between when students actually observe versus something called deliberate role modeling, because I think that's an important concept to pick up on. Then they also could have a conversation with their preceptor. Interaction with their peers became another informal learning experience. And then finally, when they actually participated in patient care was part of an informal learning experience. So this thing about observing versus role modeling. So I classified observing as really literally when the student was simply watching their preceptor. So you can see from that quote here that this was a student who's watching their preceptor. No conversation going on, and the student is taking in a certain amount of learning based on what it is they're watching their preceptor actually. I classified deliberate role modeling as when the preceptor very specifically was teaching the student. So what they weren't expecting the student by osmosis to kind of take things in. They were actually teaching the student. And so in this case, it was a role model who was teaching the student how he or she communicated with the patient and saying that it was very important that whatever you do, walk in the room, because if you sit down with your patients, they'll probably give you more information. They'll like you more than if you stand up and talk to them. So this is a very specific teaching moment about a strategy of how you can communicate well with patients. And so that's how I made the distinction between the two. And I think that's important to acknowledge, because we tend to talk about the hidden curriculum as, well, it's all about role modeling. But in the education literature, role modeling has a very specific connotation. And it's not just about watching. It's about a deliberate teaching, how you deliberately teach. And so I think that's important to pull out of the study. And then conversation was not surprisingly, about when students then would talk to their preceptors. And in this case, this was someone having a discussion with one of the eMERGE physicians. And the eMERGE physician's talking about, again, how he communicates with patients, how he tries to create that connection, a very kind of specific strategy that this person is using. And then finally, interaction with peers, I think, is as much a part of the informal curriculum as when students interact with their preceptors. And in this case, it was a fairly strong message that the student was taking away about how their peers perhaps are looking to work the least amount of hours and get paid a lot of money. And this is, you know, part of their learning environment and part of what they're taking away as well. And so we put that into the informal curriculum also. So those are examples of what the informal curriculum looks like. But here's what the focus of the actual learning experiences were about. So that was kind of a smattering of examples showing you what the interaction was. Then we turned around and said, well, what's the actual content or focus of the informal learning experience? And it just so happened that they subdivided nicely into the CanMed's roles. And so the majority of the messages that students were taking away from these informal learning experiences had to do with communication. But then you see that there were others as well around medical expert. And this is where I'm going to lose it a bit, because on my notes I had really great examples of each one of these written down. But there are 35 examples that I'm trying to pull them out of my brain to see if I can think of what else is in there. But advocating was very clearly when a patient required something above and beyond. And so the one example I could think of is when a physician wanted to refer a patient on, and it was really important to that physician that that patient get exactly the kind of treatment that he or she wanted. And so was out there advocating for the patient with another provider. And so those are the various examples. The manager one was in relation to, and it's interesting, they all kind of turned into the negative experience, was in relation to the too many patients, too little time. And that when students saw their preceptors faced with that situation, at times the response was, well, then I'm going to figure out how to maximize the kinds of patients that I have so I can move them through quickly. So this was back in response to those difficult patients. Let me make sure that the difficult patients who may take up a lot of time aren't part of my practice. So that was kind of managing the practice in a way that would work well for them. Yeah. So what I want to do now, though, is move on to some specific positive and negative examples within the communicator. And then I want to show you, which I think was really interesting, how when students came across those examples, it started to really impact on their views and perceptions of patient-centered care and what they would end up doing as a physician. And so in the communicator, here's one of the positive examples. And I think as you read through this, it's important to say that it's positive from the student's point of view. It's not a judgment on whether or not this was actually a positive thing to be teaching students. This is about the fact that the student experienced this interaction as positive from their point of view. And so this is an example where a student is being told it was okay to cry with the patients, that if she's telling somebody who she had seen since they were a child, the student says, well, maybe not that long, she's really not that old. So she's seen maybe for 5 years, and all of a sudden she has to tell them they have breast cancer. She'll sit there and cry with them, and that's okay. And this was a really positive experience for the student to actually see this, their preceptor role modeling, this kind of observing that the preceptor was doing, was providing this kind of care. On the other end of the spectrum, this was more of a negative response. So this student is saying it's the repeated visceral reaction I get when a resident or staff person leaves the room. I'm the last person trailing them, and I can see from the look in the patient's eyes that it's not for them, that they have more they want to say, but you know, we're done. And when I read this, I kind of see this student trailing out after the care team or whatever, kind of going, oh, gee, you know, feeling perhaps a bit in a dilemma in terms of what they should be doing. So when we take these a little bit further, and so this top part here is a quote that you just saw, and the rest of this now is what came out in the interview when we asked this student about what were your preconceived notions about patient-centered care, and how might that impact on your practice in the future? And here's a student coming in and saying, it was really revolutionary to me because I had in my mind. So this student is coming in with preconceived notions already of what they think patient-centered care is all about, that you as a physician can't try, and you can't share that kind of weakness. And that was really important to me. I think I would be willing to cry with my patients now. So it's not just about experiencing the informal curriculum. It's about the fact that students are internalizing this. They come in with preconceived notions. They have an experience, and somehow that experience changes what they're thinking. And in this case, this student is actually getting strategies in place that she thinks she would carry out into practice. The same thing happened with the negative experience, and this one, though, was really interesting. So the top quote, again, is what you've already seen, and this is now the additional part of how this student is filtering their experience. And they're saying, you know, before they came into medical school, they said, you hope you become the kind of doctor who's truly invested in your patients, so you care for them as a person, you want to make them feel comfortable. I had those traits in mind, so they were coming in with these ideas already. But now that I've gone through it, I've refined why it's really important so you can provide better care. And now they're saying a big goal of mine is never to let a patient leave without having addressed their concerns, maybe not solved, but addressed. And this is interesting because the student has experienced something that, in their opinion, is kind of negative, but they've actually turned it around and they're saying, I've had this experience, but you know what it's done? Is it's actually refined my previous notions and has made me even more determined that I, as a physician, will not practice that way. And so when we rolled all of these experiences up together, we found that students had kind of five different kinds of responses to this informal curriculum. They either found that they, from their experiences, took away a strategy that they could add to their repertoire. So in this case, this is a different example where someone is watching how a physician is communicating with their patient and the importance of educating and saying that this is something they'd really like now to incorporate into their practice. So they're coming away with a strategy that can actually help them in patient-centered care. Strengthen or reinforce. Refine what they previously thought of. And sometimes it's about questioning. So in this case, here's someone who's seen the pros and cons of balancing practice and personal life. And so they're seeing the opportunities, but they're not yet at the stage of actually saying, this is how it's going to impact on what I do. They're just balancing. They're just questioning. But this last one is really interesting, I think, where we think that when students encounter these negative experiences, they take it away and it becomes part of their practice. But these students actually seem to right out reject the negative experiences they came across, and they said, I will not practice that way. And so we went back to the framework and said, there's something that's missing in between the informal learning experiences and the ability to enact patient-centered care, and that's taking into account students' preconceived notions, so what they're already bringing in. And so it's this lens or this filter that students use that, you know, when the experience comes through, allows them to add to, strengthen, refine, question, or ultimately reject what it is they've experienced. And so I think that this, you know, I was delighted when we kind of got to this part of the research, because this is what we were really looking for, is how do these informal learning experiences start to impact on what students might take into practice. And I think this became a fairly concrete way of looking at that and of showing that there is a connection. We also, though, talk about students, how their experiences can kind of take them downhill or become negative as they go through the curriculum. And I think here's an example of perhaps why that happens and why it may be a normal part of students' experience. So here's someone saying that their idealism is kind of fading, but it probably strengthened my belief in the qualities that make a very good physician. So this idea that students may be, as they encounter the realities of practice, moderating what they're coming in with as a fairly ideal notion of what patient-centered care should be, which is not such a bad thing because they have to moderate it in terms of the reality of practice and what it is they're going to be facing as a physician. So that I thought was an interesting finding as well. So, in summary then, in our theoretical framework, we found in the hidden curriculum there is this specific qualities that the hidden curriculum brings to bear, which is the realities of practice, and that that has an influence on how students actually experience the informal curriculum. But the informal curriculum, their experiences are really filtered through preconceived notions that they bring in relation to patient-centered care, and that in turn impacts on how they're going to enact patient-centered care when they themselves get out into practice. So I think you can see we can start now to really make these links from the hidden curriculum to what's actually going to happen and how that means that students will practice. And then over time, this may involve a fading of idealism, but that would be something to take a look at a little bit further as well. So that was kind of the end of pulling the pieces together in a logical way around the study questions. But I'm not quite done yet. Maybe thinking, oh good, she's done, but no, not yet. I have just another little thing that kind of came out that I want to talk a little bit about because it's something that just niggled away at me a little, and I want to play with it a bit and see what you guys think. So if you think back to where we started with Charlotte Reese's presentation at AMS and the hidden curriculum, where she really talked about this hidden curriculum causing a moral distress for patients, that there is this real negative, distressful reaction that can happen, for students when they hit the hidden or the informal curriculum. I think we found, too, that when we looked at these negative experiences, that same kind of thing came out about the emotional response of students. And I think these are really strong words, I think, this repeated visceral reaction. You know, you can quite imagine what that's doing to the student. And so I wanted to explore a little bit further this emotional impact piece, recognizing that it's a small study, so we're not going to make any grand statements or conclusions, but I just wanted to tease it out a bit and see how is that actually falling in with our study on the hidden and informal curriculum. And so there was one interview in particular that I think had a fairly strong emotional impact, and I have to say that we've changed a couple of the variables in this scenario just to keep it clean and to, you know, just to make sure that we aren't breaching any issues. I don't think we are, but we left enough detail in there. I think you'll get the message, but not enough that it can be identified in any way either the student or the situation. So here's a student who has encountered this situation where a patient has metastatic cancer, she had a lot of pain, social supports were in place, and in theory she could, and she really wanted to go home. But her PT noticed that she had pain in her right hip, was concerned, and came to the student and wanted an x-ray. And the student said, she has metastatic cancer, she has 6 months, and she wants to go home. But the PT was really determined. So he went above me and spoke to the resident, and the resident ordered the x-ray. She said to me she didn't think it was necessary, but if the PT is happy, everything works out better. We found a fracture and had to consult surgery. Surgery, recommended surgery, laughs. And you know, an interview, when you get that laugh, it's often not really something funny. It's often, you know, represents that the person's not entirely comfortable with what's happening. He got the surgery, but within 2 days after surgery, he went through sepsis, respiratory failure, and died. And my gut said that we shouldn't have gotten the x-ray. And the student actually was quite upset as they were telling us this story. And so, so again, I want to say we kind of qualified the scenario so that it's not identifiable. And the point actually isn't that as you read through this, is this right or wrong care? Because who knows what else was happening? Like, this is not to put a judgment on the situation or the scenario. The point of this is to say that this was incredibly distressing for this particular student. And in fact, I think in the interview they were quite distressed as they were going through the scenario. At the end of the day, it was okay, but it was difficult for them. And so I went back to our questionnaire and I started thinking a little bit more about how can we tease out this role of emotion.
And in the C3 questionnaire, there are a couple of questions that actually deal with this emotional aspect of patient-centered care. One question asks, in terms of role modeling, do your role models actually explore the emotional aspect of the patient's illness? And then under learning relationships, they ask whether or not students talk about how the scenario, how the encounter with the patient actually influenced them personally. And when we look at the responses, we see that in terms of role modeling, the average of the response was more towards the never end. So I think it's kind of a very rarely ends up being in there, whereas all the other responses around role modeling were much more towards the always. So that's where the circle shows you that the other responses were more in the always end. And when students, in terms of talking about relationship with how the patient affected them personally, it's more towards the never. And so I started getting this sense that maybe there's an emotional piece that that we're not teasing out, or that maybe would be important to tease out in relation to these informal learning experiences and in relation to the hidden curriculum. And so it happens. Leslie mentioned that I was an education scientist in the beginning out of the Royal College, and as part of my work there, I'm doing something really interesting. I'm writing an emerging concepts document to inform the next iteration of the canon in 2015. So I've been going through all the literature, trolling what are some of the concepts that might inform future physician roles. And there's one in particular that came up, and it's the central role of emotional competence. And so this comes out of, some of you may know this new book from Hodges and Lingard on a question of competence. And one chapter, in fact, is on the role of emotional competence that they are suggesting is something new that we need to be looking at in terms of our students. And when you read through the chapter, they talk about emotions as being a regular element of clinical practice, and in fact show nicely some research about how emotions impact on clinical decision making and in turn impact on the patient outcome. But they go on to say that a closer look suggests that we tend to view them as illegitimate and undesired, and we tend to ignore them in designing health professional curricula. And so I was just kind of teasing those pieces out of it, and had a sense that there may be something in here around the hidden curriculum, informal curriculum, and patient-centered care. Maybe we need to be thinking about and teasing out a little bit more. And then I was doing some more reading around the hidden curriculum, and I came across this term called the null curriculum. I don't know if that's familiar to you or not, but the null curriculum is something like the hidden curriculum. At least we know it's there, but we just can't really see it. The null curriculum is really that which is left out. And I don't know if you recognize this little figure, but this is Voldemort from the Harry Potter, right? And Voldemort is the man whose name should never be spoken or something like that, right? And I just thought, this is kind of it. You know, this null curriculum is something that we just never talk about. And I started thinking, you know, this hidden curriculum is like these little gremlins that we know exist, and they're kind of running around, and at some point in time we can, as we've done in this study, we can capture them, we can describe them, we can make them explicit, and we can hopefully at some point deal with them in some form. But the null curriculum is that thing that we're not even talking about yet. And so I thought that maybe we need to add, in fact, into this framework, this other concept that we may have this hidden curriculum. But this null curriculum may be more about developing emotional competence with our students in relation to what they're experiencing in the clinical learning environment. So that was a bit of a tangential piece that came out of the research that we were looking at, but when you start to look at the literature on hidden curriculum, more and more the emotional aspect of these experiences that students have coming out is being really important. This concept of emotional intelligence in terms of teaching our students how to deal with emotions is becoming more and more important. And so I thought, you know, maybe it's time that we kind of formalized it and put it into our frameworks. So now I really am going to do the in summary. When we started with this question of exploring the range of student experiences, indeed, there does appear to be a range, both positive and negative, that may be important to acknowledge.
So the hidden curriculum isn't always this dilemma. There are positive things that students take away from that actually add to their repertoire of patient-centered care, and probably something that we need to be looking at as well. That students' abilities to enact patient-centered care, there is a connection. So students come in with preconceived notions of what they think patient-centered care is. They are somehow modified or influenced by their experience within the curriculum, and it does, in fact, impact on their ability to enact patient-centered care. And maybe we could do a little bit more work on exploring this concept of the null curriculum and whether or not we should be looking at strategies for developing students' emotional competence, particularly as it relates to patient-centered care. And so I'm really pleased to say that in relation to this Phoenix project, as this hidden curriculum piece became more formalized within the Phoenix project, there have been a number of grants that have come out, and Mala has a fellowship through the Phoenix project, and Cheryl now also has funding to extend this project a little bit further to formalize it more, because it's a fairly small sample. Can we do it again, see if we get similar kinds of results? And I think also an interest is in focusing more on the faculty development piece. So we talk about kind of role modeling versus observing, what does that actually mean? And can we help our faculty to unpack a little bit more how to teach students when they encounter the informal curriculum? So I'm really pleased to say that the work will be continuing on over the next little while. And it's been an absolute pleasure to be able to come and pull all the pieces together and show you kind of our evolving work and how it's coming into play. So, thank you. So I'm sure there are lots of questions. Are you willing to entertain some questions?
Without my notes, I'm still willing to entertain some questions.
Just means maybe I've got a better excuse not to answer them.
Thank you very much. I mean, it's really interesting. I guess one of the things that comes to my mind is we're really bad at communicating how we think to students. So from medical expert decision making, we're really bad. But this makes me realize we're really bad at describing why it might be good or bad to try for patients, because suddenly you make them have to care for you if you do. So that, and our students are left to interpret all on their own whether that's good or bad. So it looks good in the movies. It's maybe not good in kind of the practice, and we need to have that conversation. In the same way as ending an interview on a ward round is an important skill, we need to communicate why we're ending it at that time, why it's important to move out of the room. And yes, we need to develop skills about saying why we're doing that to the patient, but we need to move on. I mean, when people start and say, how do you do 50 minutes for an interview? And people wonder, are they ruining their relationship with the patient if they get the information in 50 minutes? No, they're not. There's a skill to doing it, you know, a skill to interrupting. So I think we need to make sure that the students aren't interpreting this all on their own and deciding, you know, making it into Hollywood,
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And that's why when I put up the example about crying with your patients, that may not be the message you want your students to take away. I don't know, but from this student's perspective, it was a very positive kind of thing. But you make that point beautifully, that it's not enough to just take it away. It needs to be debriefed and unpacked. And I know I enjoyed reading Sheila's blog on the reflective piece and how you're unpacking that more with students. And so I know you are doing that kind of reflection. I think it's very cognitive as well, though, so I'm thinking, you know, there's this emotional aspect perhaps to bring in also. But maybe in that debriefing, there's an opportunity now to go back and reinforce, unpack it a little bit further, as you're saying, maybe is required.
Yeah, I was just thinking about, I don't know about the emotional competence so much. I mean, that's an interesting concept. But when you think about as part of the learning experience, And we had a talk here by Denise Stockley a few months ago, I guess, about transformative learning.
Right.
And, you know, that transformative experience, as we were talking about then, really comes a lot from that more visceral kind of reaction that people may have to things. And so the most powerful learning may sit in these really emotionally demanding situations or things that really shake someone's preconceived notions. And yet this hidden curriculum is so much more difficult to harness and kind of make happen. I mean, it's so kind of happenstance.
Yeah.
You know? And so I don't know how you actually really engage these experiences to move students.
Well, you know what was interesting? Because at CCME, when I did the presentation, a couple of medical students actually came up and talked to me afterwards and said, oh, does this mean we need to be more aware of? And I thought, well, you know, there's one way in, is that for sure in transformative learning theory, Mesro talks about that disorienting dilemma. And maybe we can give students a heads up as to this could happen and you may experience this. And so it's not really incumbent upon us to capture every time it may happen, but if we give students the ability to identify it for themselves and to understand what it's about and what it means and how they can think about it, that might be one way in, because you can't capture it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we gave kind of four examples of the hidden curriculum. I'm sure there are many more that play out in practice than the few that we identified. So, yeah, it is slippery.
One of the things that I find really fascinating about the hidden curriculum is that the people it's hidden from are the people who are enacting the curriculum.
Yes.
And it's people who are looking in from the outside who I think might be better able to point out. Because it's difficult when you're in a culture to see what your culture is, because you're just living it every day. And a couple of examples that I was thinking of as you were talking, students and preceptors thinking of advocacy, for example, and going above and beyond.
Yeah.
That's part of the hidden curriculum, because advocacy actually isn't going above and beyond. It's part of the role of the physician. But there's something in the curriculum that's teaching the students that advocacy is above and beyond their duty. And being in the culture doesn't allow you to see that you're actually teaching people that that's the case. So one of the things that interested me is the scenario that you put up about the x-ray and the hip fracture.
Yeah.
That would be a wonderful touchstone to say, so what does this teach you about physicians' roles with physiotherapists? What does this teach you about your place in hierarchy? What did this teach you about? And start to unpack the hidden
Yeah, you're right. Because we live it, and it becomes, you know, like the water around a fish, right? You don't even know
exactly.
It's there anymore.
Exactly.
And so quickly you don't even know it's there anymore. And so I really more and more like this idea of giving medical students a heads up before they even get into it to have them kind of alert them to what they can be looking for in that case. That would be a good case study to do that. Yeah. Thank you, Susan.
So Leslie and I may have inadvertently stumbled onto the emotional competency. So we're working with the first patient program where the students work with a chronically ill patient for over 18 months. And although we should have thought of this, we didn't. And three pairs of the students lost their patient died. And so they wrote to us and said, what should we do about the assignment? So I thought, well, I can help with that. So I came up with a new assignment. And then I realized there might be something more than the academics around this. So Leslie met with the students and me to do a sort of a debrief generally, and then Leslie also offered to meet with them separately because one of the students was tremendously upset, had gotten quite close to the patient, didn't know she'd died over the summer, came back to school, and it tied in with a whole bunch of other things that he was going through personally. So we resolved that part of our project, although I am embarrassed to admit that my first default was to figure out what they should do academically. what we came up with academically, I think, addresses this emotional competence. We said, what are you taught about patients, losing a patient? What are you taught about as a physician? And they said, well, we're taught about how to counsel the family of the person who's passed away. And I said, no, but what about you? How do you, you know, deal with that and then move to the next patient who's maybe celebrating something? How do you, what do you do? Do you push it away? And informally, we asked a few faculty, and pushing it away seemed to be actually quite a good strategy that they advocated. And so I set the students to finding in the literature what there was. So we had a bit of a meeting, and they said, well, there's not a lot. There's very little. And they went to palliative care and found, and they interviewed some faculty as well as looking at the literature. So I don't know what their results are. They're going to be presenting April 30th to all of the students, because theirs is sort of an exceptional experience. And we thought there was some real learning here. So I'm interested to see what they do. And I think we have to work more on this. But there was one student who had, before she came to medical school, volunteered in a hospice and had had 3 full days of training before she could volunteer, just as a community volunteer, on grief and loss and counseling. And she said, we don't have any at all. And I thought, really? I just thought maybe encryption, I wasn't quite sure. And sure enough, no, we don't. So that alone might be a kind of an eye-opener about that emotional competency. And maybe we can offer the students something better than pushing it away. When they talked to one of the faculty yeah. member said, well, I just, you know, I push it away and then I deal with it later. And so the student said, when do you deal with it? And there was a pause, and the faculty member said, I guess I don't. And I thought that was kind of an interesting response, so maybe we can work on something else.
So that's a bit of that faculty development piece about faculty actually being able to share with students as well that these things, you know, they may have developed good coping strategies that the students aren't seeing, just assuming that it's falling off, you know, and water off the duck's back kind of thing, but not really.
One of my concerns with what Sheila said is perhaps the best way to say this is, I remember the paper by Brian Hodges, the one that he talks about the history of the cabinets, that was, you know, answered by you saying, well, perhaps he was rather, I wouldn't say vitriolic, but he was very, very critical. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting in that paper was that he raises the issues of values and how up to a certain point what the cabinets was expressing was the middle class values of a few people in Ontario. So my question to you is that in a possible process of emotional engineering, what values are you bringing with this study? Because if we contrast the training of medical students now, the training of medical students when Flexner was around, but they wanted the scientist physicians, in what way the values that you bring in about emotional engineering are superior or inferior or more positive, and how that reflects in your study, because you have not made your values transparent, and if it is a mixed methodology, aren't you obliged or compelled to make your values transparent?
So in a mixed methods, you're obliged as a researcher to make your research lens explicit. So are you coming in as a quantitative, qualitative? Like where are you? So not so much in mixed methods are you obliged to talk about your values. But let me not take away from what I think you're actually asking about. I think our values are in here because patient-centered care is the value, right? We're not pretending that doesn't exist. Like in patient-centered care, there are some pretty strong values that are attached to that. And I think you're right. I think that the assumption is from square one that patient-centered care is a good thing. So I think when you look at it that way, the values are clear. We're not hiding anything in that sense, or you know, being insidious about slipping in these emotional competences aside. Like when you look at patient-centered care, empathy is a big part of patient-centered care, which is, you know, part of an emotional competence. So, and I'm gonna just take a little bit of issue with you, with the use of the term emotional engineering, because I don't really see this kind of engineering emotions. I don't think you can actually. I don't know. I don't know. I don't. This is not my field of expertise, but. But it was just a funny.
No, I did it deliberately because it's provocative. It's like the issue of moral distress that is from the group of Alberta and how it is now pervading. You know, and the other day I had a student nurse questioning the decision of one of the attendings in the ward. And she did it on the grounds of moral distress. And we were all like, well, wow, you know, she has given her reading. So I was trying to be a little bit provocative with the bit about emotional engineering. You know, like as a psychiatrist, the first thing that. Came to my mind when you were talking about this medical student and the way that he reacted, you know, is what happened with post-traumatic stress disorder. When the notion started, we were talking about almost the trauma, and then 25 years after that, you know, a few researchers were talking about, well, no, you know, it's about the antecedents, and it is about the psychological build of the person who has the person who has the trauma. So here, the medical student, well. What are the hang-ups that the medical student has? Possibly this says more about, you know, medical students are not tabula rasas.
Exactly.
So that's another issue.
And that's what this shows clearly.
That's where, you know, the issue of value-based medicine comes in too.
Yeah.
You know, like say that this is a Nigerian or Rwandan medical student who survived Katabankatovsk, you know, like 1994.
Yeah.
And is saying, well, you know what? Distress, this is distress. I saw my mother being hacked to pieces. So that's too bad. So where we accommodate all those values in the sense of value-based medicine too?
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm just trying to throw...
I'm glad you are pushing it a little bit further. Yeah. I'm glad you are, because this is kind of new stuff that we're thinking about. And that's exactly why I said don't read this case as a positive or a negative in terms of the medical care. It's about the student's reaction. It's not up to us to judge. Who knows what else was going on. In that situation. So it's more about pushing the boundaries. But, you know, when you read the CanMeds rules, values are all over the place. But we measure what people do, not how they are or how they come to practice. And so I don't know that this is something kind of brand new that we're coming into play. I think we're just kind of highlighting or trying to take a look at something that's much more difficult to measure and to actually put your finger on, but may in fact be as important in practice. Yeah. May.
I think one last question. Maxine had a question.
I just wanted to say two things. This is one of those areas, they're very good in medical school and medical system in teaching biomedical subjects. And I think that's what we're good at. Now, all these other things that we're now recognizing or slowly recognizing that are as important or may even be more important to your patients. They're not that hot, you know, they may need more than medical prescriptions. Those are taught in a different way. There's a theory that you don't teach them like you teach cardiology.
Mm-hmm.
So you need a different, probably a different cohort of people available for that sort of thing, rather than every single faculty person learning how to do this. This is not realistic.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to, if you're going to set up a curriculum, you're going to have students do whatever, maybe we need to start looking at a different group who may include some of the faculty members, but have the opportunities. If a student has an issue, where do they go with it?
Mm-hmm.
Because if they're on the ward and they don't like, you know, something upsets them, where do they go? Can we tell them where to go? Do we have regular sessions with them where they can talk about this? You know what I mean? So I think we need to look at something in addition to what we normally do. Stop thinking that the medical faculty can do everything.
Yeah.
Because that's not really, we don't know enough.
Yeah.
And we certainly don't, a lot of us don't think that piece is important anyway.
Yeah.
So I think to support the students and to help them, we need to look at it, and it's a different way of learning. It's that kind of humanistic piece that we can't all do. So I think we have to start looking at the curriculum, expanding how we, and these need to be, you can't just go do a lecture and say this is what it is. They need to be able to feel safe talking somewhere, and that needs to be set up as part of it.
It's interesting because the person actually who coined the term patient-centered care was also responsible for creating these, what they call balance groups. And I think the family medicine, they started a number of years ago.
in a very pragmatic way. I mean, it's not, yeah, in a very pragmatic way.
And so, it may be, it's probably not bad to have it initiated by the students, as you were saying, as a question. But then you need to know where, they need to be directed or be aware of a system that they can do this in.
Yeah.
Another piece that I was thinking is, I think this would be really interesting to continue to do in residency. Because students up to the point of graduating are going in practice. They have another 3-4 years. And I think the resident piece is even more, could even be more interesting to see how it influences them when they finally practice.
Yeah.
I think that would be really interesting.
That does continue to shape and
play out. I mean, when you come in, you know, they come in with ideas and so on. But I think, I suspect that the bigger impact in terms of how they eventually turn out happens in residency. And that would be really interesting. Yeah. And is it different from the residency program?
That's really interesting.
I think that would be really interesting.
That is really interesting, and in fact, that's Mala's work. And that's a lovely segue, because Mala's doing health science education rounds in May, and she's speaking to us about looking at the hidden curriculum in residence. So come next month. In the meantime, please join me in thanking the lake. I'd like you to do your evaluations, please. They're so valuable. Also, you would have seen that we're sending around a note looking for volunteers for people who might present their work next year in health science education rounds. We're looking for volunteers before I come out recruiting. But please join me in thanking you for this really excellent, provocative, thoughtful work. Thank you so much, Elaine.